Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
The year is 1961. It's a time of uncertainty in the United States and abroad. President John F. Kennedy presented a special message to a joint session of Congress. Part of that message reads, "I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. It is an important decision that we make as a nation, but all of you have lived through the last 4 years and have seen the significance of space and the adventures in space. And no one can predict with certainty what the ultimate meaning will be of mastery of space. This decision demands a major national commitment of scientific and technical manpower, material, and facilities, and possibly of their diversion from other important activities where they are already spread thin." Good evening and welcome to the first in a three-part series of the 2006 Lowell Lectures in Astronomy at the Museum of Science, Boston. My name is Noreen Grice. I'm Operations Coordinator of the Charles Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Science. This program is presented at the Museum of Science, Boston by the Charles Hayden Planetarium in collaboration with the New England Space Science Initiative in Education and is made possible through the generous funding of the Lowell Institute. This program will be available online through the WGBH Forum Network. In January 2004, President George W. Bush unveiled a new plan for NASA, the Vision for Space Exploration, with the goal of sending humans back to the moon by 2020 and then on to Mars within the next few decades. This evening, two scientists who will discuss the pros and cons of this vision for space exploration join us. Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson is the director of the New York Hayden Planetarium at the Rose Center for Space and Earth, American Museum of Natural History. Dr. Tyson helped formulate NASA's vision of space exploration as part of the 9-member commission. Dr. Jonathan McDowell is a scientist at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and the person who writes the mission update column for Sky and Telescope magazine. This program ends at 7:20 when Dr. Tyson must depart for his flight back to New York. But now, please welcome Dr. Tyson and Dr. McDowell.
Cool.
So, good evening, Neil.
Good evening.
Welcome
good
to
evening,
Boston.
Everyone. Thank you. Thank you.
So, you have been part of this very exciting development in space exploration, the commission that is figuring out how we're going to get back to the moon and Mars. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about what the plan is now.
How are we going to do it?
Well,
some of the background of that is, of course, in 2004, President Bush said, by the way, that announcement made at NASA headquarters. There's a lot of speculation about what might have precipitated that announcement, but what is certain is that one of the strongest forces at work was the loss of the Columbia space shuttle, because America began to question, what are we doing? If we're going into space, where are we going if we're going into space? And it doesn't work if the next round of shuttle astronauts are boldly going where hundreds have gone before. That's not the mission statement people want to be operating under. And there are other factors in there as well. It was only a few months before that China successfully put someone into orbit, joining the United States and Russia as the only spacefaring nation. And so when you combine these forces, it was not only overdue, it was certainly the right moment to try to come up with a new vision statement for NASA that could reinvigorate NASA's, what NASA's about, not only as an agency, but what it means to America and to the world. So then the president says he will appoint a 9-member commission to study how this vision for space exploration will be implemented. And then 2 days later, I got a phone call. And so I became one of these 9 members of the commission.
From the press?
From the...
From the president?
Oh, did he call me up? Yeah, call me on my private line, yeah. No, no, he's got people who call my people, and then we had right. lunch, you know. So that's how it was. Now, how are we going to do it? The plan was, initially, and it's not really unfolding that in quite this way, but the plan was that NASA was doing some expensive things that were getting us nowhere, or at least we're not advancing a space frontier.
The space station.
Like space station, space shuttle. Space station advanced an engineering frontier, no question about it. In fact, so did the shuttle. But when you sum them together, look at the cost versus what it has done for us regarding how far we've reached into space, you realize it did nothing for us. And so it had to be reconceived. And the president was concerned that if he just said, here's a vision for exploration, double NASA's budget so that we can do it, that would just get laughed out of Congress. So he recommended instead, when I say he, we're referring to advisors, it's a White House document, the vision for space exploration. There's no one here presuming that President Bush was alone up at night calculating orbit trajectories for NASA's future. This is not how it works at that level. So the goal was that you would, within the existing NASA budget, phase out the shuttle, phase down our participation in the space station, which has international partners, whose participation we would then promote to be greater, a greater partner in what compared to how they were before. And in that way, you take the savings from within the budget and initiate a new path to get out of low Earth orbit onto the Moon, Mars, and beyond. We have not been out of low Earth orbit since 1972. So this was the plan. And, of course, it presumed that we would honor our obligations to international partners by completing the space station, which requires the shuttle to do. But then even with the return to flight shuttle launch, that had foam was still falling off. And the worry is that can you run the shuttle another 17 times to honor this obligation while you're trying to phase things out? And so the reality of the pure idea is now taking hold. And we have people questioning whether we should just retire the shuttle now and just sort of abandon in place and then take on the vision straight away. So that's where it stands right now.
Right. Now, after the Apollo missions ended in the 1970s, we had a period of time when NASA seemed really to be floundering, that there were no astronaut missions for 9 years. And I think there's a little bit of a fear that if you shut down the shuttle now and shut down the program now, it's going to be a long time before you see the astronauts fly again. How you phase in both the workforce on the ground and also the public interest is going to be a challenge.
That doesn't concern me. Yes, there's this fear of the gap where we stop sending people into orbit, and what do? If there's no vehicle to accomplish that. I would only fear that gap if there was not a plan in place that closes that gap,
right,
as there wasn't a plan in place post-Skylab, which we technically combined with the Apollo-era
right. sure.
missions. And so, but the vision for space exploration is clear. It's got a place to go, people to see, things to do, and that gap is just, it's like the gap when you start construction on an office building. There's a gap until it's built. But you're in high anticipation the whole time because there are people building the next generation of spacecraft. There are announcements about how you're going to get to the next destination. These are real. So I don't have the fear that many other people do. Maybe it's because I have a naive confidence that things will unfold as planned.
Now, when we heard about the vision for space exploration, I think a lot of people were excited at the idea that, okay, we're going to stop messing around in low orbit. We're actually going to go somewhere. We're going to build this future where we all live on other planets, where we colonize the universe. That's really what NASA ought to be about. And so I think there's a lot of interest, but there's also a lot of skepticism. And I look back to the photo of President Kennedy that we saw at the beginning, where a single speech and a single person, the president, pushed the nation on a new trajectory. And the 60s were an era where that could happen. But I think we're not now at a time when the presidential mandate will lead what people want to do. And why we really have to convince the American public and work in a much more ground-up way to convince people that this is worth spending money on.
I think that's a common view, but I disagree with 96% of it.
Okay.
But I'll tell you why. It's not just because I feel differently, but let me just put some evidence on the table and have you react to that evidence.
Okay.
These words that resonate within all of us, you can almost hear President Kennedy and his New England accent recite those words. Put a man on the moon, return safely to Earth. We hear that. We feel it. The hair rises up on your neck just to realize what that statement meant. But what you never read, what you never hear, what you never see people reflect upon is a paragraph in that speech, two paragraphs before he uttered those words, to the joint session of Congress. Remember the date. It was May 25th, 1961. A couple of weeks before that, Yuri Gagarin had been put into orbit and safely brought back. So this flame got lit under the rear ends of Americans. In the middle of a Cold War. So you can't just say, oh, back then we had leaders and visionary people, and that was a special time because we had leaders. Excuse me, we were at war. And what did that paragraph say? He didn't say, Yuri Gagarin, they beat us. He didn't say that. He said, if the events of recent weeks, euphemism for we got beat, if the events of recent weeks are any indication of the power of this adventure on the minds of men everywhere to decide whether they take the road of freedom over the road of tyranny, just read the speech. It is dripping with a call to battle against communism. And embedded in it, oh, by the way, let's go to the moon while we're fighting communists. And so the moon was like this add-on to the fact that we were at war. There is no question about it. The Apollo program was a militarily inspired exercise. It was not the consequence of Americans saying, we're Americans and we're discoverers. Just like we settled the West, we're going to go into space. That's our way. That just doesn't happen. The record of the funding of major projects in the history of the world does not demonstrate that nations will come together to fund science or even exploration unless there is a tagline that says, oh, this looks good, go explore. With Columbus, oh, he was a discoverer, yes. But what did Queen Isabella say? Oh, by the way, plant the Spanish flag where you're going, okay? And then bring us back some gold, make us wealthier, okay? Right. So you've got dominance going on there, and you've got economics driving that, even if Columbus himself was a discoverer. And so, you know, I'm reminded of in New York City, there's the Columbus Day Parade. Surely there's one here in Boston, as in Chicago and elsewhere. But it's a big day, right? And the entire Italian-American community comes out to celebrate this. And I'm thinking, excuse me, Italy didn't pay for his trip. Spain paid for his trip. He went for money to Italy. Italy said, nope, sorry, we're too busy building cathedrals. We don't have money for this exploration thing. Spain did it, and now most of the people in the Western, in the Americas speak Spanish and not Italian because of that one decision. Okay? There it is, the power of the Spanish Empire. So If you're empire building, then discovery works to your favor. Are we at war now? Yes, we have a different kind of war. It's not a space race yet. It's a war on terrorism, and there's the rest of what is described in the news. That's not the kind of war that drives exploration to Mars. So you're right. There's a much greater challenge getting people to wrap their brains and their emotions around space exploration. But the challenge is not because we're absent leaders. It's not because we're absent the emotion to want to explore.
I was more suggesting that we have a more cynical public today than that our leaders.
Oh, I don't think that's true either, because I remember the 1960s as the pinnacle of the civil rights movement, where GIs were dying daily in Vietnam. It was not a decade of celebration, by and large. It was a rather tragic decade with the assassinations, three major ones and other sort of lesser publicized ones. So the cynicism, I think, was at its highest. You had the... I don't think it's that easy to just say we were cynics today and not then. If there was ever a time we could not afford to go into space, it was the 1960s.
So you think the public will be behind spending a little bit of money, and it's not that much by trillion-dollar federal budget standards, on going to the moon and then to Mars and beyond?
I think that if that exercise will be expensive, that science and purely exploration alone is not going to drive it.
Right.
This is a sober revelation that I stumbled upon about a decade ago, and I wrote it up in an essay, actually it was a chapter for a book called The Columbia History of the 20th Century. And the name of that chapter is Paths to Discovery, and that is what thrust me into an analysis of the history of people's motives, for nations' motives, for investing heavily in personnel, materiel, capital, the efforts of major projects. We can make a list of the most expensive things human beings have ever done. And when you make that, and I've done this exercise, when you make that list, there are only three drivers that they have in common. It's not a whole list, it's not a book's worth of ways people gather together to do great things. It is a short list, and the list has only three drivers: war, economics, or the praise of power, as manifested by the power of a royalty, or the power of deity. So now let's look at that list. You'd have the pyramids, surely are on that list, the pyramids of Giza, the Giza Strip. You have the Great Wall of China. You have the Manhattan Project, the Apollo Project. You have the great voyages of the 16th century and the 15th century. And you look at what the drivers are.
I'm wondering if entertainment is starting to be another of those drivers, if you look at the fraction of GMP that's...
Well, no, it's...
But you're talking about single big...
Where everybody's got to wrap their head around what the project
right,
is.
Right.
And the pyramids, those are basically big tombstones that are part of the act of decision from royalty, okay? The pharaohs of Egypt.
I'm not seeing that as a great analogy to get people behind the...
No, not today, because we're not... The world isn't driven by royalty, or at least not to wrap around expensive projects. So the royalty deity thing, the deity is what got you all the cathedral building,
right,
okay, of Europe, a major time that created, you know, tremendous works of cultural artifacts that remain some of the highest tourist attractions of the world. So there's no denying the investment that that represented. But if none of those three causes are available to us to go back into space, I have a cynical view that it will never happen. So therefore, I am led to the notion that there's got to be a substrate that feeds into an economic driver. Because there's no greater buoyant force than the free market enterprise.
If you can make money doing this, it'll happen.
It'll happen. It'll happen, if not overnight, by next Tuesday. It'll happen. And yes, you need some front investment in that, a level of investment that only a government can provide. No doubt about it. But once the government recognizes that, in fact, in a way, it's kind of an R&D project, okay? You, by the way, one of the best analogies is the birth of aviation. Started out some people in their garage, all right, and the government, well, what's their incentive? Well, it's kind of fun at first, and you can, you know, use your savings to build your next airplane, but it gets expensive very quickly. The government sees the value in this and says, all right, here you go. I will bid the contract for you to carry air mail, okay? We want to get mail across the country. This is a great land we have here. We've got the railroads doing it, but we can do it faster by aeroplane. So here's the contract. If you can carry the biggest bags, you'll get the contract and you can make money by doing this. So people say, I want the contract. So you design your plane to have a bigger storage cavity, have better gas mileage, have better, you can land under more conditions, have it, what, they can survive better weather conditions. And this was a contest to get these contracts. And people won those contracts. But then you reach a tipping point where the people say, hey, I don't, my plane is good enough. I don't have to carry bags of mail. I can carry people. Thank you. Now I charge people. Government's not even in the picture. Thus you've birthed an aviation industry, with initial investments from the government. Now, could there ever be economic return to going to Mars? Probably not. But this technology is to enable that. For example, how do you get water out of the soils of Mars if it's deep within the permafrost? Somebody invents some black box to do that. Then you find out.
Spooky.
It's a sign.
Yeah. That, right. And just to say, I think that one of the most exciting things about the Vision Lunar program is the idea that once you establish your lunar base, one of the main things you do for 6 months at a time up there as an astronaut is work on in-situ resource utilization, which is a fancy long set of words which to me means working toward the day when these colonies in space can be self-sustaining.
Yeah, in-situ utilization of resources, that's way too many syllables than it deserves. It means if you land in a place, live off the land. Okay, that's really what that
means.
And
until we can do that, I don't think we'll get to that tipping.
Yeah, if you go to Mars and have to carry all the water with you and all your fuel to get back, you know, it's not a real space enterprise. If in your next trip to California, you had to carry all the fuel you would ever use when you started your journey on the Mass Pike, you'd have this fuel tanker that you'd be dragging behind your car. And most of the fuel you'd be using is just to accelerate the fuel that you haven't used yet. This is the peak of inefficiency.
That's space travel for you.
Yes, that's space travel. That's why the Saturn V rocket was 32 stories, and the astronauts were in this little itty-bitty part at the top. That's where they were. And in fact, do you see how much of this spacecraft came back to Earth? Right? Every few feet the thing went into space, it drops another piece of itself, because that's had fuel that it needed, and it's not going to carry the empty fuel tank. So it drops that, drops the other, gets to the moon, leaves the LEM behind, comes back, drops this part, and it's this little capsule, lands here in the ocean. Okay? So you want to change that paradigm if you want to treat space as a real goal. And one of the points I wanted to make is you go to Mars. Mars is dry. It's desert dry. But that doesn't mean there isn't still water there. If the water is sort of mixed in the soils, not only on Mars but on the moon, deep in the craters where the sun don't shine, there are places on the moon near the poles where the sun never gets very high. It just sort of rolls around the horizon. And if the crater rims are tall enough, which is the case for already known craters, the sun never reaches the bottom of the crater. So it becomes what we call a water trap, where comets that might have impacted the moon and the like, water molecules can just fall into that and never get warm enough to evaporate out. And so as dry as the moon is, it may have substantial amounts of water trapped at the bottom of these craters. So
plenty of ice on Mars at the poles, right?
At the poles, although not all water ice, but yeah, you have frozen.
It's there.
You've got it there. And so one interesting invention might be some device that reaches down into the soil, scoops it up, and sucks the water molecules out of it and drips it into a cup. And at the other end, you separate the hydrogen from the oxygen that gives you rocket fuel. So the same machine that gives you the cup of water gives you rocket fuel on the other side. That's kind of an interesting device if someone could invent that, because then you take it to the Sahara and extract water out of the sands of the Sahara. I mean, imagine the kinds of things you can do with the technology that enables this. So the point is that if you want to sustain, if you want to convert a space program into a space industry, without that transition, NASA will always be going back to Congress for the handout.
Right.
And here's my personal analysis of these three drivers. There's always money to protect yourself. And if you're of an evil sort, there's always money to attack your neighbor. There's always money to try to make more money. And there's always the fear factor that the king will do something bad to you, or if you don't honor your deity in the way it is prescribed, that something bad would happen to you. So these are powerful forces that transcend politics. It transcends economic fluctuations. You don't say, oh, the economy's not doing so well now, so we're not going to defend ourselves. You don't say that, because if your country's gone, you don't have the luxury of having the conversation about how well the economy is doing. So there's always money for war. History has shown. I wish this weren't the case. I'm a peace-loving guy. I'm just simply telling you, sharing with you the behavior of our species over time. There's always money for war. There's always money for people to want to make more money. But there's not always money for science. Because now you have a big science project. If it's above a certain threshold, above the radar, the funding radar, and I'll tell you what that radar level is for America in a minute. But if it's above that radar, then every couple of years people say, well, why are we looking for the Higgs boson? How does that help me? How does that, I don't, well, there were some big proponents of it a couple of years ago. Well, they're not in Congress anymore. That was then, this is now. And you know, we've got these other needs over in the other sector, so let's cut the super collider. Let's just cut it. It went over budget a little bit, so let's cut it. And so there was the physicist all wrapped around the idea that they would have a super collider that would probe the structure of matter at a temperature regime that would also tell us what went on at the Big Bang, very close to the Big Bang. And it did not survive political and economic fluctuations in Congress. But other things do. And so this is just the reality of it. I don't, you know, I wish it weren't the case. Now, what is our threshold?
What is our threshold?
A threshold. You can fund practically any science project for $1 billion. That's below the radar. Hubble, when it first came up, was $1.5 billion. Got debated a few times. It went through. The Cassini mission to Saturn, okay, it's orbiting Saturn, it's $1 billion, okay? I think it's more than that. It might be $3 billion, but over 12 years. So you divide that out. It's only a few hundred million per year. A few hundred million. Americans spend more on lip balm than the cost of that mission per year. So do the math. You find out. It's correct.
So I keep interrupting.
But no, go. Yes,
well,
I'll shut up for a minute.
So that's the threshold.
That's the threshold. The super collider was
for science.
For science, yes.
And
unless that project has a military application, funded like that, money flows like rivers. If there's a missile at the end of the exercise, that's just what it is.
One of the things I think that frustrated many astronomers like me about some of the earlier human spaceflight programs, and I think many astronomers, unlike me, do not support human space exploration, is that certainly the space station and to some extent Apollo were sold on the idea that it was science, that we were spending all this money for science. And as I think you'll agree, that I always make a big distinction between science and exploration and saying that they're you're doing it for different reasons. You want to talk a little bit
Excellent
about that.
Excellent point. In fact, I believe strongly that science and exploration are separable variables. I think it was... it would be disingenuous to assert that even apart from the war driver, that Apollo was driven by science. Yes, really good science came out of Apollo, including, most recently, an understanding of the formation of the moon itself in this collision scenario, which would have been impossibly delayed or impossible in its entirety without the data that came back from Apollo. I'm sure you all know by now there's consensus, recently achieved consensus, about the formation of the moon, that it came about from a major impact between a Mars-sized protoplanet, if you will, in the early formation era of the solar system, a collision between that and Earth. It's kind of like a sideswipe where it thrusts Earth's crust into orbit around Earth. That coalesces to form the moon. One of the biggest drivers for that concept was the moon is very low in iron content. And any mass that size formed out of the birth ingredients of the solar system ought to have plenty of iron and has hardly any. And you'd have to get its material from something that already had the differentiated material.
It's kind of broken off of something bigger.
It's something bigger that's already has the iron stuck in the middle, as we do, and then you create your body out of your crust, essentially, crust and mantle.
So that's great science, but what's
great science.
$24 billion?
Consider that the first of all the Apollo missions, which Apollo mission was the first to have a scientist on board? The last Apollo mission.
Jack Schmidt.
And so the first to have a scientist happened to be the last Apollo mission. By the way, there were other Apollo missions planned after that that were just cut. There was Apollo 18, Apollo 19, Apollo 20, 21.
Right.
Okay.
And the scientist had to fight to get transferred from one of those cut missions onto
to
last
get back. Exactly.
Out.
So let's not fool ourselves about this. The space station. I remember the genesis of the space station. It's born out of the 1980s, the Reagan era. And there's a worry that Russia would, you know, monitor what we were doing with their space station. So we needed a space station. It was a military driver. So the money flowed like rivers. Out came a space station. But then 1989 came. Peace broke out. Okay? So what do you do now that you've committed this? So the reason, the argument for supporting the space station then morphed and took on other elements. And, well, can it be primarily a science lab? There's a lot of science you can do in zero G. The question is it billions of dollars worth of science? If you go to a scientist and say, here's $10 billion, you want to do zero G science on the space station, or design
a robotic program.
Three hundred rovers, you know, and send them into the solar system.
Right, or a bunch of Hubbles.
A bunch of Hubbles, right. I mean, there's a trade-off there. It's not that you can't do science. It's what's the nature of the science
right.
that you end up
And I think
completing.
It's clear most scientists feel that robotic exploration is the right way to do science, by and large. If you have a telescope in space, you don't want the darn astronaut standing on the back of it jiggling it. And you can get, for most purposes, you can get a lot bigger science payload to a distant planet on a robot. Now, if you've got astronauts there anyway, then having them look around with a geological hammer is going to teach you things that you could never, I think, get with robots. And
well, you raise an important point, which is the perennial debate about humans versus robotic. And in my capacity in New York as first and foremost a scientist in my heart and in my soul, but I also administrate. I run the other Hayden Planetarium in New York City, and I also serve in these commissions in Washington. And each of those carries a different identity. My identity as a scientist is, no, don't send the people, send the robot. You don't have to feed the robot. The robot doesn't want to come home when it's done. Okay? You robots are really efficient in this regard. And for every one human, you could send 30 robots. So why even have the conversation? It's a simple discussion. But by the way, I speak as an astrophysicist, but there's the whole geology community
right.
where if they were given the choice, we can send a robot or send you with your rock hammer, they'd go with the rock hammer. Everyone I've spoken to.
Even if it's 300 robots versus one rock hammer?
They want to go with the rock hammer.
Okay, fair
it's
enough.
A dream come true. I know them. Some sleep with the rock hammer under their pillow. They want to go with the rock hammer. So that's a whole
that's
other psychology
enough.
Going on there. All right? I can't even pretend to understand. These are the people who, if you're a parent of one of them, they brought back several tons of rocks into the house that only a geologist could love. Right? That's a whole psycho state that I can't even
I
begin to understand.
I think I still have my little rock collection.
That's
somewhere.
What I'm saying.
It's
that's
never
what I'm
that
saying.
Big.
Right. So, now, what's my other hat? I serve the public appetite for the cosmos. And while the public appetite for the cosmos is very strong in the pure sciences, when the news came out that the Hubble might not have been repaired, The outcry, the loudest outcry, was not from the scientists. It was the public. And that told me that the public took ownership of the science. It was their telescope. They know their tax money paid for it. And it was that picture from Hubble that's on their screensaver, on their computer. And they wait for the next one to come down a month later. So that aspect of the public's relationship to science is real.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't change the fact that nobody's ever named a high school after a robot. Nobody's ever given a ticker tape parade to a robot.
I predict that will change.
Okay. So the idea that one of our own is out there exploring, mm-hmm. with or without an objective to achieve a scientific goal, but just what is it, like we didn't flesh out that distinction.
Yeah.
What is it to explore? There's a mountain there. I want to know what's on the other side. Nobody's ever been before. Let me go. All right? I'm curious. But, you know, I don't have enough money to go there. Okay, so then you have the politicians say, there could be enemies on the other side of that mountain. Here's the money to find out if they're enemies. So I'm the explorer. I go, because I like exploring, like Lewis and Clark and Galileo, Columbus and Magellan. They're all explorers, but somebody else is writing the check. So go there, see if there are enemies on the other side of the mountain, and I go to see just to explore. And then you're the scientist on the other side, and you say, oh, by the way, could you take this experiment and check the air pressure at the top of the mountain and check the, you know, the crystalline structure of the snow? And I'll say, well, how heavy is it? Oh, it's not a problem. It's only 20 pounds. Can you make it lighter? Well, I'll try. So then I carry this little science pack, and I go to him. That's what Captain Cook did. Captain Cook. His voyages, famous the world over.
Transit of Venus.
Why did he go? It was to measure the transit of Venus across the sun, the face of the sun, so that we can then use this information to map the scale of the solar system. What a noble goal that was. Was England writing the check for that reason? No! Where was this transit can only be viewed in the South Pacific? A nice frontier for the British Empire.
But then, okay. You know, if I come to the Royal Society the next year and go, I want money for this optics experiment, and they say, well, we spent all this money on science last year, then you've got a problem. So I think I also wear a couple of hats. I wear a hat as a scientist, in which I agree that robot telescopes are the thing to do, right? And I wear a hat as an unrepentant space cadet, and where I want to live in the Star Trek future, where we're living on different planets and so on. And I fully support the idea of sending astronauts out. I just don't want my science budget to be lambasted with the blame for the check.
Oh.
And that's my only issue. Which is why I think the new vision is much better than what NASA's done in the past, because they're being honest about why we want to fund this. And I'm not as cynical as you, actually. I think that the public will pay for pure exploration if we.
No, they'll pay at any given moment. Will they pay for 10 years running? Will they pay during a recession where there's an unemployment line and the media, the news reporters on the evening news go up to the unemployment line and say, can you feed your children? No, I can't. Yeah. Do you know we've got astronauts walking around on the surface of Mars? This does not play well in the press.
Right.
And so you can fund anything temporarily. The question is, can you sustain it? And that's where the rubber hits the road, or the fuel hits the vacuum.
And the rubber has already started to hit the road, because we were promised that the funding, this wonderful, exciting new trip to the moon and Mars, wouldn't bite into the science space budget, and it now has.
The problem is the ambition for the vision as it now is playing out is not matched by the funds available to do it. Were there to be more funds, this would not be an issue, because the science case is laid out in the White House document. It's laid out in our commission report. There's pages given to the science agenda that would be conducted given this new way of doing business in space. The in situ utilization of the resources, new space platforms. These are platforms, by the way, the science community, the astrophysics community, those that are cynical and don't think it'll ever amount to anything, have a certain blinders on that they might not even be able to admit to. It's, I know how to do science. We put a spacecraft in orbit, or we go to one of the Lagrangian points where you have a stable forces to maintain your craft, and that's how we do science. Well, by the way, why are you even thinking that way? Well, it's because in 1946, Someone said, well, we have this ballistic missile technology. Okay. You know the first ballistic missile? The V2. The V2, the first ballistic missile. It goes suborbital and then comes out of orbit and lands on its target. The interesting thing about ballistic missiles is if they go high enough and fast enough to go into suborbital, the kinetic energy of the thing just coming out of orbit is greater than any conventional chemical warhead you can put into the nose. So you don't even need a warhead. This thing just falls out of space and it blows up with more energy than you could have put in the nose cone. That's why ballistic missiles don't carry chemical warheads. They carry nuclear warheads, because then you could have more explosive power than the kinetic energy of the thing falling out of space. So we say, well, here's a military construct. And you say, well, if you can go into orbit with a payload, suborbit, give it a little more energy, go into orbit, and deploy a satellite, a telescope. Lyman Spitzer proposed this in 1946. That ultimately became the Hubble Space Telescope. Should have been named the Spitzer Space Telescope at the time.
But we've got one of those.
They finally named one after him, but really should have been the Spitzer Space Telescope, what we now call Hubble. But I think they only named it after dead people, I think, and he was still alive at the time. You don't want something named after you if you're supposed to be dead.
Yes, that's very bad news.
Bad. You don't ever want to appear on American currency because you have to be dead to appear on our currency. It's just what it is. Where was I before I interrupted myself?
Satellites and how.
Yeah,
orbiting satellites.
Exactly.
Old fashioned.
Before 1946, you go into a room of astronomers, what mountain can we build the next telescope to make the next great advances? And what is the seeing conditions on that mountaintop? How's that mountain over there? And how. It was like we had mountain on the brain, okay? A new way to do science opens up. We fully exploit that vision statement. It took a couple of decades because we needed a space program to enable it, but we were right on it. And so I'm simply saying that a fully expressed vision for space exploration, even though it holds the human space program as a big dimension of that vision statement, will create opportunities that are today even undreamt of for doing science in space.
That's a nice vision. I remember people who thought that about the space station and got really burnt when they spent years building payloads that were then never flown.
It's because the space station's genesis was neither exploration nor science.
Okay, fair enough.
So you had to shoehorn it back in to the design concept of what it is and what it could be.
Yeah. And just to be a little fair to the non-conservatism of astronomers. I was on a team that was designing lunar telescopes back about 15 years ago, and we were looking at it hard. Is this a new way we could do things? Decided that for the purposes we were looking at, the thermal cycling on the moon sucked, and we were actually much
plus
better.
Plus 200 degrees to minus 200, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Which is not so bad at the South Pole station that we're now talking about. But even so, it's not immediately
because there
obvious.
Is no dark side of the moon.
Exactly.
Whole generations have been just after the Pink Floyd album, The Dark Side of the Moon.
I know.
We've had
the
to
number
undo.
Of times we've had to explain that. No, Far Side.
Right, Far Side. Yeah, we have to undo the damage caused by the expectation that there's a dark side. Because if there were dark side, you'd have stable temperatures, and then you wouldn't.
Plus
have
it'd
this
be
problem.
Full moon all the time.
Full moon all the time. Yeah.
But that's right. So I mean, I think there's certainly opportunities for science to piggyback on the human exploration program, but I think it would be a terrible mistake to require us to do all or even most of our science that way. I think that.
Yeah, and I agree. And by the way, look at the drivers that are among us right now. China, you know, China spooked Congress recently.
Mm-hmm.
Congress is speaking of China as though it's a new space race, flavored differently, but many of them are thinking about it as a new space race. With that attitude, that'll have money flow like rivers.
I was going to ask you about that. I thought we'd get back to China as the big bogey because of this fear dynamic. And I went to Beijing a couple years ago and talked with some of their space people. My impression is that it's going to be hard to make China a realistic space bogey for very long. I think that they're doing some really exciting things. They've flown a few astronauts now.
Since when have facts ever mattered in this regard?
Well, in the short term, particularly at the moment in Washington, not so much. But I think in the longer term...
Why let facts interfere with a good story?
Yeah, right. Well, in the longer term, it will become clear that, for instance, every now and again they talk about their moon program of doing a sample return in 2017 and maybe starting to think about a lunar astronaut program at that time. And that gets transmuted into, you know, oh, the Chinese are going to land astronauts on the moon in 2017, and so we better rush up our program. I think the Chinese are very measured. They always say, you know, we have huge problems in this country. We have immense poverty. The space program's not the top priority. We dole out a little money, and we launch something every couple of years. And so I think that while we will see an ambitious Chinese program, it won't be on an Apollo scale for well over a decade. And so I think that the U.S. public are perhaps going to be a little, if we ramp that fear up too much, it'll be very easy for people to start going, okay, the Reds are coming, and when? And so you have to be a little careful about that.
Well, there's a subtext here. There's the 900-pound gorilla in the room. Is that right, gorilla? Which is the 900-pound? Elephant?
Gorilla.
Thank you. There's the thing in the room that no one's talking about, and that is we as a nation have basically been coasting on our investments in science and technology that came out of the post-war era, post-Second World War era. And when you coast, things look good for a while. You reap the benefits of those, the returns on those investments. But then things start catching up with you in two ways. Number one, you stop innovating. Number two, other nations saw the benefits that those investments brought this nation and start making the investments on their own, so that we end up moving backwards just by standing still. And no one complained when there were news articles about jobs overseas assembling sneakers or tennis shoes, whatever you might call them here. We might complain about the working conditions. Do they have healthy working conditions? But no one said, they're taking a job away from me. No one ever said that, because the level of that job was below what we as Americans viewed that we would be prepared to do. And now we're at a time where other nations have the technological expertise that there are jobs that we kind of would rather have here, and they're doing it. And so why is that so? How did that even happen? Kind of creeped up on us, because we stopped paying attention to the fact that a research profile that provides the returns on an investment is something that we just simply took for granted. And 2.5 generations took that for granted. So I look at the space program, getting back to what ended up as my full analysis of it. I look at the space program. Here you go. You ready? You didn't ask, but I'm going to tell you. You ready? I don't know if you know, but the Origins program at NASA, begun now some 10 years ago, was a remarkable addition to the portfolio of funding out of that enterprise. Because what it did was it created shotgun marriages between scientific branches that previously had no occasion to speak with one another. So that when you ask the question, what is the origin of the universe, for example, you look back in time, well, the universe was smaller, hotter, denser. Things broke apart into their particulate constituents. I, as an astrophysicist, I can't go there because I'm not a particle physicist. So knock on the door of the particle physicist. And now there's a new branch of science called astroparticle physics. These are the folks who figure out what happened in the first trillionth of a second in the Big Bang. Follow the water in the solar system. Why? Because every place on Earth where there's water, there's life, and every place where there's life on Earth, there's water. So if you want to look for life, you follow the water. So I want to look for life on Mars. I wouldn't know life if I stepped in it, if it's obscure. So I got to bring the biologist. Okay, so now there's a new field called astrobiology. Okay, PhDs being granted in these fields. Now, wait a minute, the soil chemistry is a little odd. What effect will that have on the capacity for it to sustain life? Bring on the chemist. Okay, now wait a minute, there's a rock structure here that is interfering with the weather pattern. Bring on the geologist. Now, of course, they're studying another planet, so technically they're not geologists. They'd be Marsologists, but I think we just call them planetary geologists. And so what was previously separate and distinct branches of science have now cross-pollinated in a fundamental way that allows NASA to say that they are the lead agency that drives public interest in all branches of science, not just astronomy, not just aerospace engineering, but all branches of astronomy. So here's what you do. Here's what you do. You double NASA's budget. Okay, why? How do you justify that? Because what is NASA? NASA is the most visible expression of exploration and science we have as a nation, that the world has. So you double the budget, and you do everything in the portfolio. And then the public sees this. The pipeline, of the educational pipeline, sees this. And everybody wants to be a scientist. They don't even necessarily want to be an astronaut. They want to be the first chemist to understand the soils on, or first ice chemist to understand the ice layers of Europa or of Enceladus.
And I think, by the way, that's already true for generations, that a lot of people who got interested in science through NASA ended up as scientists more generally.
Yes, but what I'm saying is now that all the branches of science are represented, NASA can become the leader in triggering science interest across all disciplines. And the scientist that you're referring to primarily went into the physical sciences rather than the biological sciences. Primarily.
Yes,
I'm not saying exclusively, but primarily.
And I think that's a very exciting idea.
So now here's my point. So watch. Even if those people don't become those scientists, they become scientifically literate.
Yes.
And so you promote the scientific literacy of the nation. They're more scientifically literate. There are more scientifically literate people in China than there are college graduates in the United States. As an example, of course, it's a much larger country. That's how these numbers play out. But typically, the discoveries in a nation are led by those who are the most educated. And it's not so much everybody has to be, but you have enough who are, and you reach a critical mass of major points of discovery. So here's how it works.
Okay.
Here's how it works. So tomorrow's economies, there'd be no debate here. Tomorrow's economies will be driven by innovation in science and technology. There's no question about this. The 21st century won't be driven by the economies of the 20th century will flow directly out of the return on investments you make in science and technology. The rest of the world knows that, even if America does not. So how do you promote that? You want as many scientifically literate people as you can possibly have. NASA serves that role, number one. Number two, what about the security thing? There's always money to fight a war. Is there money to promote the existence of scientists? Well, if you look at the history of conflict, while there's some exceptions to this, by and large, while bravery can make a difference in a battle, it's science and technology that wins wars. It's that simple. And so what a nation should think about is not how many bombs it stocks in its silos, but how many scientists and engineers it has in its silos. And I don't mean scientists and engineers inventing bombs. I mean scientists and engineers just being scientists and engineers. Because suppose there's like a bioterrorism attack in some place in the country. Who are you going to call? You're going to call the Marines? What are they going to do? You need to call a biologist. And you know something? You're going to want the best biologist there is. And you know something? We're going to have him. How do we know that? Because that biologist was a student who became a biologist because they were completely seduced by the prospect of finding life on Mars or in the oceans of Europa. We're going to have the best biologist. And you say, we need your help. The country needs you. They'll come when called.
I think it would also help if we taught evolution in the high schools.
These are the challenges this nation faces.
And maybe even some cosmology.
So in other words, then the space program becomes an economic plan as well as an investment in national security.
Yeah, and I think...
And there are two drivers, buoyant forces that can sustain a program.
Yeah, as you know, as someone who isn't big into building weapons and so forth, I think one of the great things about the winning of the Cold War was, I believe from my historical analysis, that a lot of the winning of the Cold War was due to the development of spy satellites, which reduced tensions and let us figure out exactly how many missiles the enemy had, and so we didn't have to spend more than we needed on new missiles and so forth. And that kind of high tech in understanding your situation in truly defense applications, I think is very important. So I take on board what you say there.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if... I'm not sure I completely buy your argument, because I think that...
Which argument?
That NASA's going to be the driver, or can be the driver, because of, I think that of science in this country.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, I think that biotech, nanotech, computer tech are things that may have enough drivers on their own from other directions that... That it'll be a balance.
Those industries surely have drivers. There's no doubt about it. The difference is those drivers are embedded within the paradigm of those industries. So in a biotech industry, you'll expect advances in biotechnology. But in one example that
but
is...
But NASA, like astronomy in general, is a synthesizing.
That's correct. So for example, let's say you're the world's expert in thermodynamics. And I say to you, and I've got this oven here, and I want you to make a better oven, because you're an expert on heat flow. So I give you an unlimited budget, and you go invent a better oven. And so you'll invent an oven that's maybe better insulated. You'd probably single-handedly invent the convection oven on your own to circulate the heat more evenly, so the cookies on multiple layers can all cook at the same time. Otherwise, you have heat shadows within the oven. You'd figure all this out, and you'd hand it to me at the end. But you know something? No matter how much time I gave you, no matter how much money I gave you, you will never invent a microwave oven, because that technology does not come out of the paradigm of your training as a thermodynamicist. That came out of that one happened to come out of investments in the Klystron for radar and military detection in World War II. And so now you've got this other investment that cross-pollinates, say, hey, this resonates with the water molecule, and water is an active ingredient in food, and so you can heat food, just like they did on Star Trek. They put it in the oven and pulled it out. I remember seeing that scene, and I said, oh, that'll never happen, not even in 2300, you know? And now, of course, you know, we're past that. So it's that cross-pollination. And another famous example...
More series like Star Trek's another way to get these new inventions.
It helps. It helps. Keeps the brains going. So these trajectories are real, these business trajectories, mm-hmm. but biotech is not going to invest in something that it does not see as a direct impact on its own bottom line in the next business okay. quarter, at most business calendar year. Yeah.
The other fear that I might have
mm-hmm.
about saying NASA's the solution to the world's problems is that I know a lot of people who are space enthusiasts who think that the best thing you could do with NASA is shut it down and turn everything over to the free market. And
the problem with that is the free market will only invest where it thinks it can take a profit. And if you go too far beyond the edge, the profit motive asymptotically reaches zero, and there are zones where the free market will never go.
Absolutely.
Because it's too far out there, and that's the perfect place for government programs to stake ground, open up the categories, and then have people flow in from behind.
Yeah.
So what NASA needs to do is not be the shepherd of low Earth orbit. There was a day when low Earth orbit was a frontier. Mm-hmm. It's not a frontier anymore. So what is NASA doing hauling satellites into low Earth orbit? What a waste of effort that is. Cede the whole thing to private industry.
Right. Give it to Elon Musk. And
yeah,
Richard
give it
Branson.
To the give it to the entrepreneurs and use NASA for the frontier that it was chartered to be and to become and to serve.
Yeah. What do you think about space tourism?
Space tourism, I love it. I think it's great. Look how much money we spend on roller coasters, you know, just to experience different G-forces. And the fact that there's any market for that at all is remarkable. The fact that we're $20 million people who are buying those tickets
to get a seat in on the craft. On the mayor, yeah. And what's interesting about that market is that it's perfectly elastic. Mm-hmm. So if you can sell a ticket for $10 million, there'll be some greater number of people who'll do it. $5 million, $1 million, $100,000. The demand right. will just be there.
And we're seeing that now with the Virgin Galactic stuff, right, where it's $200,000. For a 10-minute suborbital flight. I know a couple people have put down their deposits.
I know people who want to get married in that segment of time, okay?
I think we may be thinking the same
yeah,
people.
Yeah, no, they didn't say honeymoon. Honeymoon, that'd be too short.
Yeah, right, right, right.
So I think space tourism, that's what you need, because then entrepreneurs find, barring the analogy of the birth of aviation, the space tourism creates the innovations that the government no longer needs to invest in and that the government can, in fact, exploit later on. All right? You can say, they'll get it off the shelf or for somebody right. else's shelf because the business plan enabled it and created the efficiency and the markets of scale necessary to make that an affordable option. I think it's great.
Right. And I think that the a lot of the problem...
Oh, wait. Oh. Also, you know, if you don't have $20 million... You don't have 100,000. If you have maybe a couple thousand, go on the zero-G airplanes. You know these? They're variations on what they call the Vomit Comet. It's an airplane that executes a perfectly calculated trajectory so that you spend time in free fall towards Earth, where you're basically weightless. And the fun part about that is, whether that weightless feeling is when you go over a bump in the road and the car comes down, you feel like your heart comes up. Now imagine feeling that continuously, okay? That's why it's called the Vomit Comet. So you...
Anyone here been on it? Yeah.
Okay, so for me, the fun part of that would be, because I haven't been on it yet, is you can execute trajectories that simulate the gravity on various planets. So there's a pullout of a trajectory, a descent in a trajectory where you have moon gravity. In another one, we have Martian gravity. And that's just kind of cool, and you just sort of hop up and down, and you can moonwalk, without the spacesuit. So
right, without the funny hat.
You get a taste of what being weightless in space would be like.
Yeah, no, that's right, and I think that market has really opened up. It's exciting. That you can also, for a few thousand bucks, put your ashes in orbit. That's the other.
I'm not in a hurry to do that.
Yeah, really, I really don't see the appeal so much on that
one. But
I think part of the what
I'm
I was going
okay in the ground.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Part of what I was going to say earlier was I think the problem with NASA in the boring 90s was that very exciting on the robot side, by the way, but kind of boring on the human spaceflight side. Is this transition from NASA is a development agency. It's a research agency. It has to be, as you said, at the frontier, on the edge, and bureaucracies are not good at handing stuff over and saying, we're not going to do this anymore. And that learning this lesson that NASA has been learning of, okay, this bit's easy now, semi, so we need to hand it off and go on to the next frontier. That's very hard for a federal bureaucracy to do, I think.
Yes, indeed it is. And one of the elements of our commission report was first to appeal to the administrative structure of NASA to have it become more nimble in that regard, not only in tech transfer, but also knowing when to move from one at one time fertile enterprise into another. And the way to do that is you create such an attractive next thing to do that people willingly...
You get the good people.
You get people to migrate within the system. But if you don't have a nice carrot out there, then it stagnates in place. And that's part of what happened during the 90s. So there's one point I want to make before perhaps we can go to the audience for questions. While space has always been politically motivated, there's no question about this, it has never been partisan until Bush made his announcement about the vision for space exploration. Mm-hmm. And immediately everybody chose up sides because the election was so divisive. The consequences, are you red state? Are you blue state? Are you... Now, here in Boston, the cradle of democratic voting. There's certain things you might take for granted. For example, it was popular to just presume that anything that would happen if you vote Democrat, that anything that would happen out of the Bush White House would be bad or would no good. And so it tainted before analysis the introduction of this vision for space exploration. And evidence for this was Gallup did a poll. I think it was Gallup CBS did a poll where they asked the public. They said, President Bush is about to announce a new vision for space exploration where we'll go to the moon, Mars, and beyond. Given the cost, given the needs of the society and the cost and benefits of this plan, do you agree or disagree with this path? Okay? 45% agreed, 55% said they don't agree. Okay, fine. But Gallup was smart because they knew how divided the politics were. They reworded the question and asked the other half of the respondents, because they only asked the first question of one half of the total people. They reworded the question slightly, yet still have the question be formally equivalent to the first one. So instead of saying, the Bush administration plans to send us back to the moon, Mars, and beyond, what do you think about it? They said, the United States plans to send astronauts back to the moon, Mars, and beyond. Do you agree or disagree? The percent in favor of it went up to 55%. And so what it said was, is that there was this sort of political poison in the air that prevented people from thinking rationally about this vision statement. And this concerned me deeply at the time. And I said, here's the vision statement. Just read it. Just read it. It's all there. It says phase out the shuttle, reduce our participation in space station, honor science, okay? This will promote science in the schools. This is good for our economy. It's good for national security. It's all there. We like exploration. Exploration need not necessarily have science as a part of it because the urge to explore is real. We shouldn't stand in denial of this need. Exactly. It's all there. And so the triumph of the vision came about much later, now 6 months ago. There was a vote in the House of Representatives. Do you endorse the vision for space exploration and NASA's directive, or do you not? They voted 384-15 in favor of the vision. And you don't get votes like that ever in Congress. So the space exploration vision reclaimed the non-partisanship that it was born as and that the history of our efforts in space have always been. And so I'm just pleased to announce that. And so now we can get on with the business at hand. And when I mean that it's never been partisan, what I mean is you could not predict, based on a person's political affiliation, whether or not they were pro or against our efforts in space.
Right.
And that's what I mean. So it's not only bipartisan, it's nonpartisan in the history of that. So can we go to the audience?
Yes, I think we should go to the audience now. Thank you very much, Neil.
Okay, sure.
A great discussion.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And we may need to repeat the questions when they get asked.
Yes.
Okay.
You said earlier that no high school has ever been named after a robot. What about a mouse or a chimpanzee? I remember in the 50s and early 60s, before we sent a man in space, we're doing very well sending mice and returning them safely to the Earth. And let's not forget our chimpanzee Ham. I've heard nothing about whether or not Russians sent animals in space safely and they returned. We've only heard about the dog Laika, which didn't return. So my question is, A, were there any animal experiments in space in Russia that you know of? And B, why has the American public not, thought highly of these test animals?
Right.
Well, why does it have to be a man?
I think maybe I can take some of that. The Russians did a lot of experiments with dogs. The first recovery of living animals from orbit was done in August of 1960 when two dogs called Bielka and Strelka came down from a Vostok prototype, and that was only the day after the U.S. recovered its first film capsule from a spy satellite. That was the first recovery. So the Russians were very active. They liked dogs instead of monkeys and chimps. They later flew monkeys in the 70s and 80s. So they've had an ongoing life sciences program. In the United States, I think there's been a growing feeling that animal experiments were both potentially cruel to the animals and not always telling you more than you can do with humans who get paid to have needles stuck into them. So they were very careful. In fact, when they flew two monkeys on a space shuttle mission in 1985, they didn't give them names. They were just number 381 and number 385, right? So that the public wouldn't get attached.
Were they monkeys or chimpanzees?
These were monkeys. These were Samiri Securus, the squirrel monkey. Mm-hmm.
But there's another factor here. If you're sending some life form other than humans, you're presumably doing that to explore the effect of that environment on the biology of the human. And that's a different motive than sending astronauts to Mars to hammer on the rocks, because your object of affection is not the survivability of the astronaut, but the geology of your destination. So we're largely past the experiments on the effects of...
I don't know.
What's that?
I don't know, because I think that in the long term, mm-hmm. what we want to do is not just hit rocks, we want to colonize. And when we colonize, we have to take the entire terrestrial biosphere with us, because we cannot exist without it. So someday we'll go back, but I agree in the short term we're past that.
If I were to take the biosphere, I'd leave the mice behind. Right, okay. The third things you can leave back here on Earth. Another question.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. First question. With the Spaceship One, I read some criticisms about it that it really wasn't realistic as a spacecraft because it was really only suborbital. Do you have any comments on how that approach would scale? I thought it was interesting that they appeared not to need a heat shield and anything
right.
like
there's
that.
Is that an issue? There's a huge energy difference of about a factor of 20 to 25 between Spaceship One and an orbital craft.
I think consider the following, okay? You may remember in your physics class that if you toss a ball between two people and you map the trajectory of it, you say it's a parabola, and you can get the equation of motion for that object. But in fact, it's not a parabola. It's a segment of an ellipse. And that segment of an ellipse, if all of Earth were located at its own center, then that trajectory would execute an orbit around Earth's center and come right back to where your hand is. So any tossed object is technically suborbital, number one. So number two, but they don't say this. And in fact, it led to some wrong answers in physics review exams. But they say, what is the trajectory that a tossed object takes? And ellipse is one of the choices, but they really want parabola. And in fact, it really is an ellipse. But they wanted the parabola because they weren't thinking of the total story. So Spaceship One, which was this airplane rocket that launched, I think it was deployed and then went up. It reached, what's the limit, 100 kilometers? So
about
62
100
miles up. That's a very arbitrary definition of space. Okay, 62 miles up. Here's Earth. 62 miles up is the thickness of the epidermis of my skin, or less. To call that space is generous. And now you want to go up to there and say that's the first step to now going sideways 18,000 miles an hour. You are correct. That is a really big difference between those two scenarios. And you don't just scale this up and then go sideways 18,000 miles an hour to sustain orbit. That doesn't mean that you couldn't still sell seats on this thing. Because when you're 62 miles up, the blue sky turns dark because you're above most of the glowing atmosphere. And there's the sun in the sky, and you see stars surrounding it. So that's still a worthy trip to take. if you can do it safely. And you've got to crawl before you walk. So I fully endorse that exercise, but it is important not to overthink what that is versus what the goal is.
That's right. There's a whole set of technology differences there, then you're very right to point them
out. And the heat shield, you need that when you're going 18,000 miles an hour and then have to slow down. Okay. When it went up to the top of its point, it's going 0 miles an hour, and then it just sort of accelerates down. It'll hit terminal velocity if it's just falling, but it's got wings, and so it'll fly. So there's no heat problem in what it has. But there is one if you go into orbit.
Second question. I've read a great deal lately about the space elevator idea, and there's some claim they could build it for $10 billion. How realistic do you think that is?
Not a hope.
The space elevator, in case you were not up on this, it's an idea that achieved some popularity in an Arthur C. Clarke novel some years ago. But the idea is, at 23,000 miles above Earth, the time it takes an object to orbit Earth happens to be exactly the same as it takes Earth to rotate. So that's where all of our communication satellites are based. That's geosynchronous orbit. Anything lower than that, the satellite moves faster than Earth's rotation. Anything farther away than that, it will take longer than Earth's rotation. The moon is farther away than that, and it takes longer for the moon to go around the Earth than it takes Earth to rotate once. So it's just a continuum of places where orbits will take different times. The fastest orbit you can get is about 88 minutes just above Earth's surface. But you'd burn up in the atmosphere, so that's a bad place to have something. You want to go up a couple hundred miles. Then it's about a 90-minute orbit. So at that point, if you want to get to that spot, the idea was you could lower a ladder down to Earth's surface. And then you're here on Earth's surface, and there you just climb the ladder.
And if you do it from geostationary and make the ladder each way, go each way, your center of gravity is still fixed over a point on the Earth.
Right, that's the detail of the execution of this. So the idea is, it hovers above your head anyway, just go to the spot and climb the ladder. You can get to orbit cheaply. But to make this work, the ladder has to be able to hold up its own weight for 23,000 miles. That's nearly the equivalent of the circumference of the Earth. Okay, that's number one. The people laying the transatlantic cables had this problem because at the deepest parts of the ocean, the very weight of the cable, even in the buoyant ocean, was heavy enough to snap the cable in multiple places, and there was a major effort trying to lay that cable, the transatlantic cable, for example. So the weight of cables matters, okay? Not only that, if you're going to climb up, you're changing the center of mass of the system. You don't want that to happen because that'll put the satellite dynamics in the wrong place. So what you need is a whole ladder extending the opposite direction. So like the cable cars, where one goes up the hill, the other goes down the hill, and they're always kind of like that, you need one where you climb up and the other thing comes in together, always keeping the center of the mass the same, like that. Right. So you need two things sticking out, 23,000, and it's got to be strong enough. So you have this, do you remember the buckyball from a few years ago, this carbon 60 sphere? It was a kind of cool new molecule form of state of carbon. Well, you can add carbon chains in between to make it a tube, and you get bucky tubes. These are really strong, stronger than steel. So there's talk that they want to make these ladders out of these bucky tubes, 23,000 miles worth of ladders.
But now you've got, 46 because of the counterweight, and now you're doing the environmental impact statement to say that, okay, I don't think this 46,000-mile-high tower is going to fall down on the neighborhood. and we've flown 20-kilometer-long tethers in space and had problems with them. So I think any near-term space elevator is not really on the cards, and certainly not for that money.
But it's nonetheless fun to think about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think we might be running out of time. Maybe one brief question.
Okay.
Yeah.
I take a couple more. I can squeeze it. It's the shuttle, and they're good about this sort of thing. Who's got the microphone? Yeah, whichever one. On the aisle, yeah? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was wondering what the present size of the sort of economics of space exploration, science education, everything related to that is now and whether that figured in the commission's deliberations, like what's the present economy, including NASA, everyone it employs, all the engineering spin-offs, and maybe the whole science education industry to boot, you know, and all the economics of that.
I can give you some basic numbers. And meanwhile, could you work that to the next questioner so that we can go straight to it when I'm done with the question? Some quick numbers. The NASA annual budget right now is about $16 billion. In constant dollars, that is measured on the same economic scale, it's been about the same for decades. In fact, if you go back into the 1960s, we went to the moon and back and Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo for about this much money per year, which is part of what gave us the confidence that we could leave low Earth orbit once again for the same money, provided the internal workings of NASA were conceived. Now, out of that money gets distributed to various congressional districts where there are NASA centers, Kennedy Space Center. This is all part of that budget. Kennedy Space Center, that's in Florida, of course, Johnson Space Center, Jet Propulsion Labs, Goddard Institute in Maryland. Places such as this tap those monies. And so when you look at the economic impact of the simple NASA budget, it spreads wide and far across the country. Part of the buoyant force that keeps the MAN program going is the number of places that serve the MAN program, the aerospace industries that build the parts that make the rockets, that make the satellites, that make all of this. Now, that, however, is not the right measure of the economic fertility of the exercise, because that's all tax money. You don't want tax money to use as your measure of how successful something is. You want to be able to attract industry money into it. And so by various measures, there's a number that's bandied about that the economic leverage factor is a factor of 7. That when you look at the industry spawned by industries and the people employed by those in the service of the NASA contracts, you get a factor of 7. Now, there's some slop in that number, and it depends on how you cut the edges of how you make that calculation. But for my money, the greatest intangible there is the inspiration factor that made someone become a scientist that might not have otherwise done so. It's hard to measure that economic impact, because they then go off, get a job, invent something, create a new industry, and meanwhile they're reflecting on how they were moved by watching Neil Armstrong walk around on the moon. So I think that's the real economic impact, more so than just where does a dollar get handed out. Another question, yeah.
Yes, hi. I'm interested in your comments about the need for both a short-term vision as well as a long-term vision, and the different kinds of sciences devoted to both of those visions. You know, we have this really nice short-term vision that we've been talking about all night, and the long-term vision that says we need a home to go to when Earth, you know, is enveloped by the sun when it dies, or global warming when it's no longer hospitable, so we need to hop to the moon, to Mars, to Enceladus, or wherever we're going. That's the much longer vision. But mostly what we've been talking about is the shorter version, the vision. And there's a different kind of science that is involved with both of those two things. How does NASA, how does the science world deal with that division of longevity of vision, I guess?
That's an excellent question. The long-term visions, that's still the purview of science fiction. The idea that you would terraform Mars and make it arable and habitable just like Earth. You know, we can't predict next week weather on Earth here. To say that we can terraform Mars and make it just like Earth, I think, is a pipe dream at this moment. But again, it's not, doesn't mean it's not worth thinking about, but to take that as a serious near-term consideration, I think, is misguided. That's my opinion. With regard to how you transition from a short-term to a long-term vision or otherwise, the vision for space exploration, what's fundamentally different about it from previous visions for going into space was when Kennedy said, we're going to the moon before 1970, and that's it. That's time, your place, your destination. And what happens? You get to the moon, you look around, you say, okay, I'm here.
That's nice.
Yeah, all right. All right. You know, I'm coming home, and if, you know, so So you need a way to have your vision statement be more fertile than simply establishing a target. That's why it's not mission to Mars. It's not mission to Moon.
It's the beyond that's important.
It's a mission to space, where the act of taking that mission to space includes journeys to the Moon, journeys to Mars, journeys to killer asteroids that we might want to deflect one day, journeys to comets, to Europa, all right? Like I said, one of the moons of Jupiter that may have liquid water underneath and might have life. And I wonder if we find life there, would that life form be called Europeans? Because it's Europa. We got top people working on that question right now.
But one thing I quickly say, Neil, is that I think that something that's changed as a result of the recent stuff and also the discovery of exoplanets, which has been very influential, is that as a scientist, I'm no longer considered quite so wacky just for talking about having a long-term vision, right? It's no longer embarrassing to say, let's look for other worlds that we could live on. Let's talk about terraforming. So it's not in the near-term budget, but at least it's a legitimate topic of conversation, and that's great.
It's an excellent point, because whether people view you as crazy or not is an important distinction between whether you get funded for an idea or not.
Although I think we're both regarded as crazy in general.
And so in the 60s and 70s and 80s, at any given moment, there was one space probe moving through the solar system. Everybody was crowded around the data that came from that. Here, as we speak, we've got a mission to Pluto. We're in orbit around Saturn. We're in orbit. The European Space Agency, is in orbit around Venus. We just entered orbit around Mars. We've got two rovers on Mars. We've got telescopes positioned, observing the universe in wavelength bands undreamt of in the days of Galileo, undreamt of 50 years ago. And so the universe has become our backyard. And that's a remarkable transition from what it once was. So the people who say, oh, the public is, they're not interested anymore. They're interested. When the rovers landed on Mars, Spirit and Opportunity, in the weeks that followed that, the websites at the Jet Propulsion Lab that tracked the movement of the rovers.
There were flames coming out the back.
Do you know how many hits? They got a billion hits. A billion hits. The hits to that website, for a brief period, exceeded the world internet traffic in pornography. So you know.
Whoa!
You know NASA's doing something right. I got
to
get back.
I have to thank Dr. Tyson and Dr. McDowell for a very animated conversation this evening. Next week, we will have the Lowell Lectures at 7 p.m. with Dr. Jeffrey Hoffman, who is a space shuttle astronaut, who will be talking about exploring space with humans. So thank you very much, and we look forward to seeing you next week at 7 p.m.